As I said, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is my pleasure to be here. I was very, very shocked when they asked me, quite frankly, because I just do what the program tells me to do. And that's everyday business. It's nothing special. It's just what my higher power says I need to do. First of all, before I forget, I need to thank the committee for inviting me. It's a beautiful facility, and I'm very grateful to be here. However, I must tell you that I will be more grateful when this hour ends. I make no bones about it. Speaking is my least favorite. It even ranks below the fourth step. Because this is the kid that had to take her mother's nerve pills in order to pass high school speech. So that gives you an idea. Believe it, it'll be all right. Falls all the time. I grew up not being able to walk and chew gum, so my higher power has a really funny sense of humor. He gave me an excuse for not being able to walk and chew gum. They tell me that I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I am a fourth generation adult child of an alcoholic. That's as far back as I can trace it, as far back as my father could trace it. I always knew that there was something weird about what went on and the way people behaved at our house. Didn't know what it was because it was normal. But I did know that other fathers could handle a crisis one way and never break a sweat, but come through the back door screaming and yelling and taking off his belt because the first kid he got to was going to get a beating for the bicycle left on the front lawn. Didn't matter whether it was your bicycle or not. Well, by the time I was 12, I'd figured out that my brothers were 9 and 10, and it was every man for himself. So if I could hide, if I could get away first, fine. If I couldn't, that's the breaks. By the time I was in grade school, they were asking my teachers, "What's wrong with Linda?" Nobody knew. They said, "Oh, she's immature. She'll outgrow it." Well, that's fine when they say that at 9. However, at 69, it has not shown any signs of going away. I still have it. I've just learned to cope a little bit better. Now I don't try to walk and chew gum. For one thing, my dentures keep me from chewing gum, so that takes care of that. Come to find out, I have multiple learning disabilities. Not only do I have dyslexia, I have dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and perceptual handicaps that I can look at something. My mother tried to teach me to draw a house because I was putting on both ends of the house in the front. She said, "Well, Linda, come on, I'll give you a lesson." She did, and she said, "Now, draw it like I drew it." I drew it the same way I'd been drawing it. Even though my eyes told me that I couldn't, my mind said I could. And it took me a long time to understand the mental fatigue that went along because I knew that something was wrong. And at the age of 8 and 9, I began to paint this wall. And it was what I wanted everybody to believe that Linda was. And I didn't care what you said about me. You could say I was lazy. You could say I wasn't living up to my potential. But as long as you didn't call me retard, it was okay. Nothing else mattered. Because you see, the little grade school I went to in Missouri, you had to go past the special ed classroom to get to the girls' bathroom. So every day, multiple times, I went past that classroom. And I knew what the kids in my class said about the kids in that room. And I just knew that because of the way I learned, that's where I belonged. So here was this charade that went for years. And even after I got into the program, it wasn't until I had a sponsor who said, I want you to go through, in the moment of silence, I want you to go through the first three steps, and I want you to take out the word alcohol, and I want you to put in learning disabilities. And that was the first time that I found out that I could use the program of Al-Anon for something other than the alcoholic nightmare that I was living in. And the reason she suggested it was because I was afraid to share for fear that I was wasting the group's time. Because in this day and age of computers, I have a mind that works like a Rolodex. Here I am flipping through looking for the right words to try to explain what I mean. And so I was very hesitant about sharing. And I went through it for about 3 months, like she told me. Of course, at that time, in Somerville, South Carolina, there was only one Al-Anon meeting a week, so I didn't have to practice it too much. Now we have seven, so I practice it a lot more now. But it came out in my sharing. And I thought, what's going to happen now? Because you see, at home with my husband and his sober in AA mother, that was the chief stick that they beat me with. Anytime I disagreed with them, it was, oh, that's okay, you're just a retard anyway. So it was not a very conducive environment for me to be open with them in any respect, in that Al-Anon saved my life. Because I quit taking trips to the hardware store to buy a loaf of bread. I started going to the bakery instead. Bakery provided me with a lot better service. But somebody said, is that why you talk so slow? Somebody else said, is that why I try to finish your sentences so you'll hurry up and get the words out? These were my friends. But the one that really struck me was that the gentleman at the end of the table who wouldn't tell us his name, that I had nicknamed Mr. Anonymous, he said, my son's got that. It's no fun. Because one of the things that goes with it is a tremendous amount of mental fatigue. Because everything I do, my ears hear English. Unfortunately, my brain speaks Russian. So everything I hear has to be translated in whatever's asked of me, completed, and then translated back out. So the mental fatigue is tremendous. It also means that a job that somebody can do in 40 hours, if I'm lucky, I'll get by with doing it in 50, unless it's math, and then, it may be the end of time. My parents, I was very, very fortunate because they didn't find out about the learning disabilities. Indeed, I didn't until I was a graduating senior out of college. So they always expected exactly the same things out of me that they did out of my younger brothers. It was, you can do it. You need to get busy and do it. Of course, that earned me a lot of smacks from my mother over algebra. Because when she would get too frustrated, she would say, Linda, listen to me one last time. And I didn't listen. And that step I'd been leaving out all along, I left out again. And she'd smack me and she'd say, now listen to me. You got to put that in. Oh, okay. Light does dawn on Marblehead sometimes. With me, it usually worked better when I got some kind of smack. Well, fortunately now, my higher power chooses to use a spiritual 2x4 instead of an actual slap. You know, there are advantages to everything. I grew up under a very tight control of my parents to an extent. Anytime that my behavior got out of control, they told me not to act like my grandmother. I hated that woman. Absolutely despised the ground she walked on from the time I was old enough to know what she was like. On the other hand, I adored my grandfather. Both of them were adult children. Today I know that she suffered drastically from untreated alcoholism. I used to say that if she would just take a drink, it couldn't be any worse. But she hated alcohol, wouldn't allow it in the house. But she rode roughshod over everything and everybody. And my grandfather was a pacifist, peace at any price. And he was in ill health. He had had to retire before I was born. And for her to pick on him all the time, she had to have a target. And he was one that wouldn't fight back. When I was 12, they moved across the yard. The clothesline divided the two houses. And by the time she got to the clothesline, I was already angry. All I had to do was see her coming. Now, I wasn't the only one. My father and my brother were also that way. My younger brother and my mother would say, "Oh, she's not that bad." And we'd immediately say, "Oh, yes, she is." Well, you know the old saying, "You spot it, you got it." Well, the three of us were exactly like she was. And so it really kept me under control until I got away from home. And then, man, it was 1 minute and song, and Linda was ready to party. My mother used to say that she always thought I was slow until some guy got too serious, and then the only thing she saw was elbows and tennis shoes because Linda was running. I didn't have the foggiest idea how to have a relationship. I was pretty good at going to the Hilton and picking up somebody at the bar when I didn't want to spend the night alone, but otherwise, you know, that was as close to a relationship as it was going to come because I didn't have the foggiest idea. I was still back behind that wall that I wasn't going to let anybody in. That way of lifestyle went for 17 years after I got out of high school. And my folks would say, "Aren't you going to get married?" "Nope. Still playing. I'm having a good time." And they would make little hints about, "Well, you know, we really would like some grandchildren, more than just the one we've got." And my response was, "Go talk to my sister-in-laws. I'm not interested." Which probably would have been a blessing for that unborn child that I wasn't interested. When I met and eventually married the alcoholic that brought me into these rooms, his disease was so minor that I couldn't even recognize it, because the others, every one of them, was worse than the one before. It was a continual downward spiral. I frequently heard from the in-laws and the outlaws in the family that my life was a train wreck that was already happening, and I was just too oblivious to know that it was there. And it really was. I even had a job that if it was Washington's birthday, I was already working on the 4th of July or Labor Day. So I never knew what day it was. Not only that, I had to supervise salespeople who drank. And I was so heartless that I made up a chart on a piece of poster board and put it on my wall. And when they would call to tell me why they were scheduled to work and they couldn't, I tell them not to bother to tell me the story, just give me the number on the list. Because they were all familiar with the list because it hung on my office wall. Number one being I'm still drinking and I don't want to go to work. And number two was I'm hungover. And number three was my dog died. So just, yeah, there was a whole list there. They could just pick and choose whatever they wanted. It really didn't matter to me because what it meant was if they didn't show up, I was going to have to go work in their place. And sales was extremely difficult for me because I was hiding behind that wall. I was good at it, but it was difficult for me. After I married the alcoholic, life was good in Oklahoma City. I had a job. I was on the road half the time. Plus, I had commissions. He had a job that kept him in town as a sales trainer, and he had commissions as well. And there were very few problems because I found out that for Friday night date night, all of the bars would serve me steak at the bar after we went in for, let's just have a couple of drinks, and he wanted to drink some more. And man, I was ready for that steak I had gotten promised. So I wasn't going to miss that. And so it was easy enough. Really wasn't a problem. And then we got the offer to move from Oklahoma City to Greenville, South Carolina. And at that time, I had been holding back moving because I enjoyed my marketing job. But I found out that my supervising vice president and my division manager had blocked a sales promotion that would have given me San Francisco, Oakland as a territory. It was one of the top three jobs in the country for sales and marketing for this particular company. And the reason they blocked it was because I was the one who was propping up the division manager. 2 weeks after I left, they showed up and changed the locks on the doors and fired him. But they had to get me out of there first. Things happen for a reason, because the particular lifestyle that I was living, whether or not I would have found these rooms, is doubtful. And I remember when the new boss called me and said, guess what? They were waiting at the doors with the locks changed when your former boss got there this morning. And I said, what? That's not fair. I wanted to be the one to hold the door when they fired the expletives deleted. And he said, now, darling, that's the way he would calm me down when I'd get on my high horse. You know it's better that you're out of it. It's not fair. The whole 3 years I worked for that man, that's the only thing I wanted. Because he stole out of one, he had his hand in one pocket to steal from me, and his wife had her hand in the other pocket. And so I was very vengeful about it. And I realize now that would have been absolutely the wrong thing for me to do. Because I was not vengeful as long as I was in front of them. I gave them the due respect, even though I did practice CYA a lot. 6 weeks after we had been in Greenville, things had gone from being okay to an absolute disaster. That last month before I started going to Al-Anon, our landline phone bill was $425. In a day and age when the average landline phone bill was $50 or $60. And finally my mother said, Linda, I don't know what to tell you. I've never dealt with this. you're going to have to get some help where you are. Because I was 847 miles away from the only support system that I'd ever known. So the telephone was the only choice that I had as far as communication. And, well, I've got to do something, and I didn't know what. My mother-in-law had tried to get me to go to Al-Anon when we were living in Oklahoma City, but it really was not enough of a problem to push me to my bottom. By the time I went, I was firmly convinced that I truly was the insane one, the sicker one, because he did exactly what was normal. He drank too much and he passed out and he sobered up the next day or came to the next day. That's normal when you drink too much. It has to happen. Either that or you die. And he wasn't that bad yet. Me, I cried and I pounded my head against the wall because it hurt less to do that than it did to deal with the pain on the inside. And God help us, the poor dog. He sat in the corner and he shook and he peed on himself because he was too afraid of either one of us to come to ask to be put out on his leash so he could go to the bathroom. Talk about a sick household. And it, you know, we did a pretty good job of being sick. I mean, we were sick enough to make the dog sick. I mean, you know, you don't get much sicker than that. I was lucky. The first night I came to an Al-Anon meeting, they had a speaker. My higher power knew I was thick. I needed something that would give me hope. And that's what I heard from her. She's still a dear friend today. And I still do not remember any more that I heard other than I could feel better. In that room full, they were laughing and talking, and I was miserable and crying. And for about the first 3 months, I sat in the back of the room and I cried. And I cried. And I cried. I did use the phone list. But thinking back, I called the one person in the room who was as sick as I was. She came in the first night I did, and she was in no better shape than I was. So I obviously was not looking for a great lot of help. More than likely, I was looking for sympathy. But I came back because I wanted what they had. I wanted to be able to laugh again. But the trip to get there was going to be long and hard because that wall that I had built up was so thick that it kept me a prisoner. It didn't keep the rest of the world out, except to a certain degree, but it made a prisoner out of me. You know the poem that we have to learn in high school English? Iron bars do not a prison make. Well, when you paint your own wall and put it in front of you to try to protect yourself, you've created a pretty good prison because you're the one who designed it, not somebody else. Very quickly, I got involved in service. Right after I talked to an individual that I had asked to be my sponsor, and what I wanted was a divorce. I wanted her permission to leave. And she said, "You want me to tell you that it's all right for you to leave? It's all right for you to get a divorce." Crying, of course. I mean, then I didn't bother anybody else, but boy, I sure got on my last nerve. I'd never cried so much in my life. And she said, "I will, under one condition.
What?
She said, you have to be able to tell me honestly that you can walk out of this relationship and not take one single solitary bit of what has happened with you. And I sat and stared at her because I knew that if I answered it honestly, I would have to say that it was embedded so deeply that there was no way that I would ever be able to walk away and leave it and not take it with me. And again, I said, the expletive's deleted here. I guess that means I've got to stay. And I had enough sanity left to know that once I made that commitment to stay, that regardless of what he did, as long as it was not overtly injurious to me, I needed to keep my mouth shut. He needed to work his own program. I needed to concentrate on me. Because when it came to a war of words, he was going to win. He talked louder, faster, and longer than I did. I used to call his method of conversation or discussion Chinese water torture. Because eventually I would say, whatever you want, I don't care, just go do it, leave me alone. It took me many, many years to understand that I was trying as hard to control him as he was to control me. And that's exactly what was going on. One of my favorite sayings from One Day at a Time is from Confucius. Says that it takes two fools to fight because a wise man won't fight with a fool. Well, I hate to tell you that there were two fools living at our house. We were never agreeable about anything. I came from one of the poorest counties in the United States outside of Appalachia, and I had grown up. Going to school was a way out. Because my folks figured I'd wind up 21, pregnant, barefooted, three kids hanging on my skirt, and they wanted something more than that for me. So I went to school, and I got out. He came from 45 minutes west of New York City, where if everything looked good on the outside, it was perfect. And I'm here to tell you that I could have cared less whether or not it looked perfect on the outside. I was all about the way it was on the inside. And if I tell you that that didn't create clashes, culture clashes, I would be lying through my false teeth. Because there were clashes that wouldn't quit. Why can't you be more like my mother? If I were in the mood to fight, I'd say, why would I want to be like that phony? She's as shallow as a saucer. Definitely out to start a fight. Work too. Took a long time for me to get smart enough to say, I'm sorry you feel that way, and then run. Because you can't hit a moving target. And it takes them a while to learn to figure out how to respond to, I'm sorry you feel that way. As a matter of fact, at one point I found him down on his hands and knees looking under the bed. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm looking for the tape recorder. And I said, what tape recorder? And he said, well, I hear, I'm sorry you feel that way in my sleep. And so I was looking for the tape recorder because I thought you were trying to brainwash me. I laughed until I almost got down on the floor and rolled. Because that was the first indication that I had that anything I had said was getting through to him. When we got married, I didn't marry a man. I married a Coors beer can. Truly, that's all I knew about him, was I married a Coors beer can. And if it had not been for a joint AA and Al-Anon meeting on Saturday night in Simpsonville, South Carolina, I probably would not have ever learned to talk to that man. Because, you see, he refused to ride in my piece of crud car. That meant we had to take his pickup. And we made it a no-conflict zone to and from the meeting because it was between 30 and 45 minutes cross-country to this meeting. So, no arguments, no disagreements, no nothing. If we couldn't say something nice, we kept our mouths shut. Because he knew I was quite capable of getting out and walking. And then I didn't have the excuse. But we would talk on the way back about what was said at the meeting. And I remember one time I went and things were so bad I went and rented a lawnmower because it was to the point that, you know, we could have baled it for hay. And we were living out in the country, so it was a real possibility. So I went and rented a lawnmower. And the ensuing discussion, for want of a better term, revolved around the fact that he would get a divorce if a lawnmower ever came on the place again. But he did finally come out and help me finish it because he said all the neighbors were looking at him because I was working and he was sitting inside. At that point, I didn't care. I was almost done. Just let me finish it. But we went to a meeting that night. And one of the things I shared in the meeting was that before I would rent a lawnmower again, I would cut that 3/4 acre lot with my manicure scissors before I listened to the stuff again. And we were coming out and he said, "Do you really feel that way?" I said, "Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear it again." I said, "It's just not worth the effort." Luckily, we sold the house not too long after that because we were moving to Charleston, the Charleston area. So I didn't have to carry out my threat to cut the lawn with the manicure scissors. Out of all of the things that my marriage brought to me, the thing that's the most important was that it got me through the doors at Al-Anon. And I was enough of a rule follower that whatever they told me to do, I was going to do. So I went to meetings. I read the literature. I got a sponsor. I used the phone list. I didn't start working the steps right away. What I started working right away were the traditions. Because things were so bad at our house that I felt like I needed to put my effort into calming things down a little bit because they stayed at the semi-explosion level 24/7. And so to calm them down a little bit, I started working on the traditions. It was our common welfare, which meant I could back off and get myself out of the room. I could detach physically, whatever I needed to do to kind of calm things down. Because if this were the proper venue, I could show you that I still have sneaker prints on my backbone where he used me like a doormat on a regular basis. But that was my fault because I internalized things. I wound up with 2 bouts of thyroid cancer as a result of not being able to turn things over and being able to verbalize what was going on. I literally let the disease make me sick. when we moved to Charleston, I got very involved in service immediately. The new sponsor I picked didn't give me any choices. She said, "We've got a district meeting Saturday. You need to be at my house at such and such time." What I found out was that they told everybody else 30 minutes after the time they gave me, because they knew that way I'd be on time, because otherwise I was going to be 30 minutes late. But I went. They told me to run with the winners, and I went. When I was the convention chair for 2002, when it was all over, my sponsor said, "What did you learn?" And I said, "That I could survive," because I'd managed to get through it without standing up on the table and yelling, "We're going to do it my way. Stop arguing." Which is what I wanted to do, because after all, I could be right a good portion of the time. Nothing like ego speaking, folks. Luckily, my higher power had his hand over my mouth, so I didn't do that. And I could sit there and let them talk as long as they needed to talk. And we would get through it. My co-chair, she said, "Can't we just speed this up?" And I said, "If we try," I said, "if we cut them off, it's going to come back and bite us." Because that had happened at the convention 5 years previously. There was stuff going on at the area level, and it trickled down to the convention committee. And every decision we made at one meeting, the next meeting we'd reverse it all. And I decided that was not going to happen. Because, you see, I have about that much patience today. Then it was, you know, as a matter of fact, my friends today, they know the story about how I act so much like my father. They call me Little Arthur when I get out of control. I say, "Okay, Little Arthur." Because when I would do something like that really bad and my mother was still alive, I'd call and say, "Hello, this is Little Arthur." And she'd say, "Oh no, Linda, what did you do?" Because she knew that whatever it was really, really, really bad. Because if I would admit it, there was no way, even without it being in black and white, there was no way that I could get around what I had done. So there was that grain of truth there. But boy, it had to be plainer than the nose on my face. After I was the convention chair, like I said, she asked me, and I told her that my sponsor, that I could survive. And I said, "What do you think I learned?" And she said, "It's the first time I've seen you be able to put the traditions and the concepts into practice." She said, "Before, I would have put your book knowledge of them up against anybody's, but you hadn't had an arena in which to practice them." Today, and for a number of years now, I work a horizontal program. When I work step one, I also work tradition one, and I work concept one, because they are three individual discussions about humility. Just like step two, tradition two, and concept two are three different discussions about trust. And if I've got one of them that's giving me trouble, the chances are the others are giving me trouble as well. So they need that attention. The attachment that I have for the traditions and concepts is extremely strong. As strong as the steps were in the beginning, when that was the only thing that I could hold on to. I've learned not to try to control someone else. I've learned to be me, to put away the wall. Now I can vaguely remember what that wall was like. But when I hear a newcomer sponsor or a newcomer share about the things that are going on with them, I may go back. Will cause me pain, but not the same kind of pain that it caused me then. And I don't live there anymore. I can empathize with them and tell them that it got better for me. I can't say that it will for them, but it got better for me. And it is time for me to begin to wrap things up. And I think, let's see. Number one, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. The differences between me today and me from yesterday are unbelievable. The friends that I went to school with do not even recognize me as being the same individual that I was then. I still don't know right from left. I still can't open a combination lock. But those are the details. Why sweat them? We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. The self-doubt which used to imprison me is gone. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Today, my past is simply the raw materials from which my present was created. I'm sorry, I have to resort to this, but I can't remember them. Four, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. Today, as the Alateen Day at a Time reader says, serenity is not the absence of the storm, but rather it is the calm that exists in the middle of that storm. My peaceful heart depends on my keeping the wreckage of my past and my present when my alligator mouth and my hummingbird backside get out of control. No matter how far down the scales we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. In the beginning, I thought that my marriage to the alcoholic was such of short duration before sobriety that I couldn't possibly have anything to share. Today, I share about being a fourth-generation adult child of an alcoholic and all of the disease that it brought with me. And I can assure you that it has continued into the fifth generation with my niece and nephews. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. When I became involved in service, it really did disappear because I believed that I actually could do something and not mess it up because I had lost that ability to see what needed to be done and be able to do it once I had recognized it. I became trustworthy and demonstrated integrity again. We will begin to lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. My main objective in life is no longer to make myself look good, but rather what I can do to help someone else. I'm a caregiver for someone who has dementia, and I rescue animals, particularly cats. I help those who cannot help themselves. I practice Al-Anon's silver rule. Do not do for others what they can do for themselves. Now, I will get you a cup of coffee, but maybe fix you a meal, but as far as telling you how to fix your world, you are on your own. You need to go talk to the God of your understanding. Self-seeking will slip away. The humility which comes from being a trusted servant. And I will tell you that that humility absolutely knew no bounds when I was elected South Carolina's delegate. And I got to the conference and I'm looking around my room and saying, oh God, what am I doing here? I am out of my mind. I can't do this. And then I thought, wait a minute, South Carolina thought I could. I've got to try. Before, I had grandiose dreams, and they always imploded. I was going to write the great American novel. Well, the only thing I was really good at was grading, was correcting my little brother's English papers, because I could spell and use commas and he couldn't. So much for the great American novel. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. No longer is my self-esteem dependent upon what I'm doing. I am a human being, not a human doing. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. Less and less, I see glimpses of the old Linda who would just look at you and smile, but never speak. Not only that, I wouldn't wear red because I didn't want to call attention to myself. Now, paradoxically, I wouldn't wear brown because I didn't want to blend into the woodwork because I had brown hair and brown eyes. I really was a train wreck happening. No longer do I panic over money. 5 years of workman's comp showed me time and time again that the God of my understanding would meet my needs. Not my wants, because I can tell you folks, I got champagne taste. But these days I have a water pocketbook. Those two just don't match. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Today I work a program with 36 principles. The steps, the traditions, and the concepts of service, which provide the framework for the good, orderly direction necessary for my intuition instead of my insanity to function. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Regardless of my desire to be different, without the God of my understanding, absolutely nothing that I do today would be possible. Today, he's no longer a God who's concerned with world peace. He's my best friend. I can talk to him anytime. I don't have to worry about anything else as long as I can talk to him. And I want to leave you with one last thought. It's a quote from Abraham Lincoln on addiction. I am not bound to win, but I am bound to be true. I am not bound to succeed, but I am bound up to the light I have. Thank you all.